My name is Maximus Decimus Meridius.
I am Iron Man.
Hello, hello, and welcome back to the Post Credit Podcast. I am your host, Eric Italiano, senior writer at BroBible.com. Today, I am joined by my buddy, Brandon Katz, who you could find over at Parrot Analytics. We may be joined by my co-host, Cade Onder, at any moment now. I'm not sure. Cade has the benefit of youth, which allows him to stay up super late and sleep super late and not feel guilt for it. Brandon and I now 30. B, you are 30, right, as well?
Yeah, I turned 31 on Sunday, so I'm a 31. Week after you.
Oh,
a
wow,
week
there
after
you go.
And a year older.
Wait, this Sunday coming up?
Yeah.
Okay, good. All right, cool. Yeah, so we are not blessed with that gift anymore, so you're just stuck with the two of us for today's episode, at least for now. First, we are breaking down chapter 18, and I guess a bit of chapter 17, basically season 3 of The Mandalorian so far, and then on the back half, we have my 25-minute interview with Andy Serkis. We're talking Andor, Last Jedi, The Batman, the new Lord of the Rings film, and his role in the new Netflix film, Luther, The Fallen Son, which hit the streaming service on Friday.
This man is everywhere.
I know. He's crazy. He's in the MCU, Planet of the Apes. I mean, it's nuts.
Him and Stellan Skarsgård, the ultimate franchise utility players.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. All right, let's start out with The Mandalorian, Chapter 18, The Minds of Mandalore. In an effort to redeem himself for taking off his helmet, Mando and Baby Yoda, after stopping by Pelimoto for a tune-up and also an exposition dump, because that's basically the only reason that they stopped there, so they could just tell us a bunch of shit.
Yep.
They head to Mandalore so he could bathe in the waters of Lake Minnetonka. While exploring the mines, Mando, who still can't really wield the Darksaber, is taken captive by some kind of robot bug. So he sends Grogu to get help from Bo-Katan, who was right about Mandalore not being cursed. B, you and I have not really had a chance to speak on The Mandalorian Season 3 so far. Any big thoughts that you want to take a swing at first?
I mean, I get that they set this up back in Book of Boba Fett, his quote-unquote redemption for taking off his helmet. It's just so funny to me to see him talk with Bo-Katan in both of these episodes, someone he respects, someone he admires, someone he's willing to follow under, you know, the right circumstances, and someone who doesn't represent his specific creed of Mandalorianism. You'd think that thought would start to get into his head, like, oh, maybe there is more than one way, and that religious zealotry is going to cut me off from the world instead of open me up, just like Grogu has. So it's just this as the thrust of early season 3, his redemption and his commitment to this very specific zealotous sect is not interesting to me at all. In fact, it's counterproductive to me. So I'm bored, man.
Yeah, I'm banging my head against what I've seen so far as well. And I think it's sort of an extension from Boba Fett and the decisions that they've made there. I think it was an egregious mistake to effectively nullify what was not only the dramatic crux of season 2, but the dramatic crux of the series so far. That was the splitting up of Mando and Yoda. Now, as I said at the time on this show, knowing that that's the dramatic crux of the show, they weren't going to keep them apart for long. But you could have spent half a season easily on Mando figuring his own shit out, Yoda training, and like have whatever emotional turmoil that being apart might cause them play out on screen.
It's just crazy. And then you have Jon Favreau and Dave Filoni saying like, oh, actually it's been 2 years, and we're learning that off screen and in the real world in an interview bite. You know how you maximize
the true
that's, or that's what they said.
Is that a misquote? That's really what, because like that feels for somebody, for a two guys who have so lovingly crafted such a complex world, for them to just be like, oh yeah, by the way, it's been 2 years. What?
I mean, it's crazy. You want that dramatic tension and that time to be really felt. And like you just said, you really want to maximize the narrative crux of their dynamic, which has been the main focal point of Mando for the first two seasons. Keep him out until the last scene in the penultimate episode of season 3, which, like, okay, maybe you won't sell as many toys because you don't have as much Baby Yoda, but that's a really, really cool way to be like, wow, this footprint of impact was really felt, his absence was felt, and his return is a huge dynamic development within whatever the journey is.
But they could have, you know, I mean, maybe rendering Luke that much would cost him too much, but he could have been in the show, just not with Mando. You know, like there could have been.
I think that Luke should have never been in the show, but we argued about that last season.
So, I think that, you know, Mando's redemption, similar to Yoda's time with Luke, is just a massive narrative acceleration. Like these are events that you feel should play out over the course of multiple episodes, and yet they're getting it done in one or less. And I'm hoping. I don't think that this is how it will play out, but I hope that because they've sort of zoomed through the duo's reunion and Mando's redemption, and those were maybe like the hurdles that they had to clear in order to tell the sort of reclaiming of Mandalore story that they want to tell. And from here on out, maybe they'll have a bit more of a narrative footing and serialize itself a bit more.
Maybe. I doubt it. As we've seen in the first two episodes, it's still Mando needs to go to planet Y to pick up part X to accomplish mission Z so he can do X, Y, Z, A, B, C, 1, 2, 3. And I'm so tired of that format. I think it's so limiting and restrictive, and I get it. That's what this wants to be. We should stop arguing about what we want it to be and give it credit for what it is. I do understand that counter argument, but I think now that we're on episode, 18, we have seen this play out so many times that maybe they can reinvent the episodic format a little bit.
Yeah, and I was thinking about that when I watched The Last of Us. Like, does being aware of the format lessen the dramatic weight? Like, every time we have now been trained in that show, every time you're introduced to a new character, odds are they're dying before the credits roll that night. So does that sort of foresight take away from what should be the excitement of the show? So in a similar way, because we're so familiar with the format of this show, which again is like sort of how TV has always been done. So, you know, that it's not as if it's doing something wrong, but. And I wonder if we're getting to this point in the MCU too, where maybe we've just, you'll know the term for it more than I have. We've just hit a ceiling where it's like, you know, 3 years ago, Disney execs thought, we need to chain these people along from a Disney to Marvel to, from a Star Wars to Marvel to Star Wars to Marvel throughout the entire year. But what they've done is lessen the spectacle of it. So when Mando came out, we're like, fucking sick, live action Star Wars show. This is awesome. And people were hooked. I feel like the season 3 premiere snuck up on everybody. I didn't feel like there was as much of a cultural discussion around it. I think that now that it is less eventized, similar to Boba Fett, it makes me wonder, with the lack of the serialized core narrative, why am I watching this?
Yeah. I mean, they've already said, Kevin Feige and others, that they're going to pull back on volume. But just in general, if you're looking at both Star Wars and Marvel, you could cut back on half of the annual content lineup and still keep that same level of audience retention, subscriber retention from a commercial standpoint. So I'm hoping there is a general pullback and, that we're not oversaturating the market with what something we've grown so familiar with. Having said that, I'm super, super stoked for The Acolyte. That sounds like it's going to be something different, takes place outside of the Skywalker saga, going to follow a dark side user. That has all the ingredients I want from a fresh Star Wars.
You've been saying that for literally years.
Yeah.
My heart's going to break if it fucking sucks a fat one.
I think it's going to be good. You know what? Between this episode of Mando and this episode of The Last of Us that you just mentioned, I put this out in a tweet. Pedro Pascal characters have really needed their surrogate children to save his ass a lot lately.
Yeah, and to be fair, seeing Yoda sort of take the reins was one of the things that I liked about this week. But we'll get to that a bit. And then, so that was my complaint on the narrative side. And then from a technical point of view, and a lot of folks have had this complaint, this episode is literally unwatchable at times because it is so dark. Now,
yeah,
I don't understand how this could happen in a series. Just a couple of years ago was getting hailed for the way it pioneered this incredible volume tech and was creating these incredible sci-fi locales. And now they are going to a location that has existed in Star Wars lore for decades. They have been planning to go to this planet for years, and yet it is visually indiscernible. I couldn't see a goddamn thing. I don't know how big the mythosaur is. I don't know what the fight scenes looked like. I couldn't see a goddamn thing. And it's just like, look, man, if you guys are spending this much money and this much time and are going to be bouncing us around from locale to locale and planet to planet and storyline to storyline each week, then show me. I couldn't see the mines. I couldn't see nothing.
I just want to put Mythosaur up there with Unobtainium in the most unintentionally hilarious sci-fi junk jargon. Because it's like, what? Mythosaur!
You don't get it, Brandon? It's mythical. And it's a dinosaur. So it's
but yeah, I agree with you. And it's so funny. There's a great Bo Burnham bit where he goes on for like 5 straight minutes. I'm not exaggerating on how skinny Pringles cans are. And he finishes the joke with, he's like, just make them wider. Like, it's so easy. And that's how I feel. Just make it lighter. It's so easy. Just make it lighter. How is nobody in the editing bay be like, just going to turn up the brightness 2%. Boom. There you go.
Yeah. So that's frustrating as hell. All right. Let's keep going here. With the help of Bo-Katan and to his credit, some legit big boy heroing, Grogu is able to rescue Mando, which allows for the pair of Mandalorians to have a discussion about their differing ideologies. As Mando begins to bathe in the living waters underneath the mines of Mandalore, he's quickly taken underwater. That's the real name. Yeah. That's really what it's called.
I know. It's like the mines of Moria from Lord of the Rings. It's just, I don't know. When you see it here, it's just silliness.
Yeah.
Listen, I'm a huge genre fan. Like, obviously I love other silly shit that other people kind of are like, probably like, that's dumb, but I don't know, man. The writing here, it's just not doing it.
That makes me wonder how Oscar Isaac must have felt when he sat down to read the Rise of Skywalker script. And he was like, you want me to say who returned how?
And I always like that. I can't remember, but some eagle-eyed Star Wars fan said the word Palpatine is never used in the original trilogy a single time. I'm like, that's amazing.
Oh my God, what a disaster. I was actually to prepare for Circus. I went back and watched. Have you seen those GQ things where they talk about their most iconic characters? Yeah. They're great series.
Love it.
And he was talking about how when he was mapping out Snoke, I don't think he meant this as a diss, but he said like, yeah, there wasn't really a plan for like where the character was going to go. So we kind of just made it up on the spot in The Last Jedi. Not like on the spot, but I'm saying right. Like, there was really no direction. Like, hey, in episode 7, he'll do this, and 8, he'll do this, and not none of that shit. All right, Damon Lindelof, you got this, our boy.
he's gonna pull it off.
So as Mando begins to bathe in the living waters underneath the mines of Mandalore, he's quickly taken underwater by a mysterious creature, leading Bo-Katan to have to rescue him once again. That creature turns out to be the mythical Mythosaur, which has seemingly renewed Bo-Katan's faith in reuniting and rebuilding Mandalore. As I touched on, you know, I'm not just trying to sit here and bash though. So if they are going to use this episodic format, similar to the way that the Mando shows were the best part of Boba, I thought that Bo-Katan was the best part of this one. And to change the sort of protagonistic perspective from Baby Yoda, where you're like rolling with him for a bit, and then you're with Bo-Katan and you're with her for a bit. And I understand that Mando and Pedro are the draw, but as you just said, the format is becoming so familiarized and ingrained in our expectations of the show that for the sake of its survival, for the sake of its freshness, it has to change it up. And I think that this was a way to do it, you know, similar to how Nightwing and his fucking batons have a completely different fighting style than Batman does. Same thing here, right? These are two of the same ilk, but they have a completely different fighting style, and that adds something exciting and new to the series. So I do, and I like this actress who I had never really heard of before this. So I do hope that in an effort for variety, maybe they bring Boba back in somehow to work him into this sort of plan that they got going on. But if they shift character perspectives a bit more, I think that will help alleviate some of the repetitiveness.
I agree. And Bo-Katan is the clear standout of this episode. And the actress Katie Sackhoff has been great, you know, dating back to Battlestar Galactica, which is a big genre nerdy favorite. So she's well-versed in the kind of space genre. And I believe she voiced Bo-Katan in the animated series as well. Though someone's going to have to fact check me on that. They need to continue incorporating other perspectives if they're just going to continue relying on the episodic format. I think as we've seen in the first two episodes, this is very much a Nexus series, to borrow a Marvel term, that builds off into, you know, Ahsoka, that Cobb Vanth is probably going to show up. It was going to give the Cara Dune show. So I'm expecting a lot of familiar faces to pop back up.
Just hearing you talk, though, what is the dramatic force driving this show currently? In season one, it was Mando has to protect Baby Yoda from Empire scientists who want him. Okay, that's a very clear goal. Season two, it was Mando needs to get him back to his people and continue to fend off said Empire. What is that sort of log line of season three? Because I have no idea right now. And if it's Mandalorian and Bo-Katan set off to reunite their home planet, which it seems like it's going to be, and yeah, Jon Favreau's Lord says, I don't give a fuck.
See, I care about that. I think that's cool. It just needs more than like...
But what is the dramatic tension there?
I think it's interesting to see him as a homecoming, because that's basically his whole ingrained character is what his roots mean to him. I'm glad that hopefully he will expand beyond just the very specific religious sect that he belongs to and learn a lesson in terms of acceptance, and that culture doesn't have to just be one way to be shared. I think that's interesting. But again, we're two episodes in. That hasn't really come to the forefront in terms of a broader global scale within the logistics of doing that. And we've got six episodes left. It's hard for me to build that up to the same degree. And I think season one and two flowed into each other really, really nicely. Season three is, in a way, wipe the slate clean, start from zero, which is hard. It's hard to pull off.
I know.
And so far, I'm bored.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's not to say that I'm somebody who believes Jedi and lightsabers need to be in every project, because I'm a guy who literally parades around saying Rogue One is the best Star Wars film of all time, Andor is a revelation. You know what I mean? Like that, you know, so I don't need, but what I need is conflict is story. There is no story without conflict. And I had expected this season to sort of build up to a Bo-Katan and Mando having like almost warring factions and recruiting their own soldiers to duke it out for who's going to be the new king of the planet or whatever the fuck the title is. But now that they've seemingly resolved their problems through what I think was a somewhat enlightening conversation about what they associate being a Mandalorian with, whereas Mando very clearly associates it with a set of beliefs. Bo-Katan understands it in more physical terms and understands it as a people and a place.
So as God as a people.
Right, exactly. Exactly. I did enjoy that aspect of the show. But now that the
conflict is the interesting part, but that they haven't done a great job through the whole show. I mean, Moff Gideon could have been really cool and a lot more of a terrifying villain, and really just petered out for the most part. Right. And I don't think they've done a good job of establishing overarching conflict in terms of an oppositional force, not necessarily within their own character dynamics, which they've done well with Din and his compadre.
But they didn't roll out Moff Gideon until the penultimate in season one. And I think season one was the best season, maybe.
I like season two more than season one.
Okay.
You know, I think we can both agree that Moff Gideon ended up being a big fat nothing.
I guess my point is, if the counterbalance and the counterpoint and the conflict point is no longer Bo-Katan, then who is it going to be? Is Moff Gideon going to come back? Is that the assumption? Because he's on the cast list for season three.
He's going to ride a mythosaur into battle.
Well, because he's not dead, right? Did they kill his ass? No, they didn't.
I can't even remember, honestly.
No, I don't think they did.
I think maybe they arrested him. Wasn't he going to kill him? And he's like, wait, no, this is the new civilized era.
Yeah,
and I'm just... Probably should have killed him.
Yeah, some high horse bullshit. So yeah, I mean, I do hope that, you know, not to say that I hope they introduce a big bad, but I do need some sort of dramatic anchor here, because right now with... Go ahead.
No, it's just it's clear from the rescue too that like Bo-Katan's getting back the Darksaber, right? That's
absolutely.
An obvious
guarantee. And I don't even think it's going to be like much of a beef.
She has to take it. She can only win it in battle, the Darksaber, which is I think what's also prevented them from just kind of handing it over. Because I'm pretty sure it didn't in season two. He offered it to her back to her. And she's like, I can only win it in battle because that's the way it goes.
Yeah, but I guess, but doesn't finding it on the ground because its owner was too much of a bitch to keep hold of it, doesn't that count as like
This seems like Harry Potter rules, where it's like Snape wasn't really awarded the wand because it was a setup.
Good old loopholes.
Yeah, exactly.
Good old sci-fi loopholes. All right, so as this episode, it's sort of mic drop, cut to black moment is the reveal of the mythosaur. What is that? Well, via Nerdist. Well, B, don't.
No, just like I'm like a really pretty significant Star Wars fan. I mean, you know, I'm not like poring over every detail ever. Right. But I've never heard of the Mythosaur. Right. So like, I think I'm like probably 75% more than the average, but still 25% less, the diest of hards. So if I'm not even familiar with like whatever this reveal is, and it's just another beast in a long line of beasts.
Well, we've heard about it in the show. Your boy Queel said,
"You are a Mandalorian. Your ancestors rode the great Mythosaur. Surely you can ride this young bull."
Like, it's the sigil on his arm. So it's been brought up, but I don't think the layman is supposed to understand the dramatic impact of what that means. So, yeah. And Bo-Katan reads a sort of plaque.
Right.
That sort of explains its lore. How convenient.
Like, the whole planet was destroyed, but I'm glad our natural museum of history is still standing.
All right. Via Nerdist, ancient tales say that the first Mandalorians tamed massive mythosaurs and rode upon their backs. Queel referenced this legend in The Mandalorian's first season. Then on the Book of Boba Fett, the armorer, man, you're just right. There's just so many fucking words and shows and terms and characters. I have read three sentences and there's about 10 nouns in there.
It's hard to keep track of. And that's also the downside of having a Nexus show that feeds right off into others.
So on the Book of Boba Fett, the armorer told Din Djarin about the prophecy of the Darksabers. Whoever wields it can lead all of Mandalore, she said. That wasn't the only prophecy she shared with him, though. She spoke of another sign that portends when the promised hero will unite their people. The songs of eons past foretold of the Mythosaur rising up to herald a new age of Mandalore, she said. But according to the armorer, sadly, the Mythosaur only exists in legend. I think that explains sort of the final shot of this week being on Bo-Katan. Even though you literally can't see her face, I feel like her facial expression is meant to be understood as if her mind is kind of blown, right? Her cap has been peeled back. Her whole shtick about Mandalore's dead, blah, 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 you know what I mean? She was like, oh, wait a minute. Hold up. Wait a minute. You know what I mean? So, and now I think that seeing Din Djarin wielding the Darksaber and coming in contact with this beast and all that shit, I think that that's beginning to bridge a gap between the two. But to that point, I had to fucking read an article to understand that. And you never want that.
Yeah, it's too much homework to a degree. And again, okay, I'm really glad that they've mentioned it before. And obviously it just didn't burrow into my head. But isn't the dramatic climax of the show then dulled because I have no idea what that big fish thing is?
Right,
and,
exactly.
And I am assuming not only that, I'm speaking but, brothers.
And not just that, but you can't even fucking see it.
Yeah, it's like, I don't exactly know what we're supposed to do with that in the moment. And now that we have a week to do our homework, and I'm sure it'll be exposition to death in the next episode, I don't know. That's not necessarily what I look for in my highest anticipated blockbuster shows.
I just pictured being literally expositioned to death. Like, you're just chained to a wall and someone's just like reading War and Peace in your ear until you lose your mind.
It's like a Clockwork Orange, but in the real world.
All right. So look, I think that that's all for this week. I'm going to continue to tune in, but I think that that's the problem, right? I'm watching because it's a Star Wars show and not because I give a shit. And that is in direct opposition of how I felt about season one and two, whereas season one had one of the few moments in my life where that Star Wars magic hit me right in the fucking chest. So to see how far the show is going down the other path is disappointing.
I mean, hopefully it turns it around. I do believe that when we were covering season two weekly, we thought it started slow and picked up. I'm hoping that's the case here. But as I said on Twitter too, not that it's necessarily fair, but it is what it is. In a post-Andor world, it's hard for me to get super psyched about Mando.
Yeah, yeah, true. Andor season two, though, probably beginning filming this year. All right, y'all, let's take a quick break, and then we will come back with my interview with Andy Serkis.
Hey,
Andy,
Eric.
I'm honored, man. I'm excited. How are you, man? For this. Folks, today I am joined by Andy Serkis, an actor you know from every film ever made. No, I'm just kidding. An actor you know for projects such as Lord of the Rings, Star Wars, The Batman, and his new film, Luther the Fallen Son, which hits Netflix on March 10th. Like I said, it is an honor to be joined by you today, sir.
Oh, thanks, man. Lovely to see you.
So I want to start with your character in Fallen Sun. My first note at the top was this character felt like he was straight out of the film Seven. Your dude was scary, man, in like a way that when a human could feel like this omnipresent threat, that is what I think your character achieved, a very boogeyman-esque thing about him. So what I'm curious about is, how do you ground yourself in a villain that doesn't have any redeeming qualities at all? Because we've heard the cliche of, you know, I love a villain that believes that they're the hero of their own story. This is not that guy. So how do you go about grounding yourself in that? Or is it instead about not grounding yourself and embracing sort of the alienness of it?
Great question. And I think the thing about David Robey is that he almost doesn't exist as a human. And that is the tragedy. There is a tragedy to the character. So without making any excuses for what he does, because he does despicable things, he is a psychopath and he is a serial killer. But he is a very lonely, isolated human being who has no other way of connecting with humanity other than through observing, voyeuristically, and kind of almost like a vampire, watching them through their own devices at home, because they've given themselves up to this wonderful thing called the internet. He is able to spy on them and watch the most mundane, boring things that they do from day to day, from, you know, picking their teeth to cutting their toenails to, you know, doing their washing to whatever it is. And he sucks elements of their lives because he has no life of his own. So the David Robey character is basically that much David Robey and the rest reflecting society and society's willingness to buy into the internet. It's all in all its awfulness and brilliance. And so the monster is actually what's out there that we've given up responsibility to and washed our hands and gone, okay, look, I have a technology that can be hacked, I can lose my identity to, that I can be, you know, made through deep fake to look like someone else. I can, you know, and so on and so on.
I know these deep fakes are terrifying.
So, you know, and David can only come into existence by shaming other people and absorbing them, but also then manipulating them. And so, like I say, he's the tip of the iceberg, which is this big monster being something that we have all around us and that we're happy to hand over to.
So you bring up tech. Something I could not think about is you are an actor, the actor who's perhaps synonymous with the use of tech in film. So I'm wondering if that was a calculation on the creative team's part to have the tech actor become the tech killer. And how do you, Andy, a director and actor, feel about the use in tech in film? Because there are some franchises out there, not to name names, that have gotten a lot of heat in the last few years for their CGI. So I'm curious how you feel, as since your character was sort of weaponizing the dangers of tech. How do you feel about it in your job?
It's a really interesting one, and it's reached a really interesting moment in its kind of evolution, really, I suppose. Because, you know, now if I think about it, you know, my body has been scanned, my face has been scanned thousands of times. So in terms of my own identity, you know, my movements, my physicality can be, you know, in terms of deep fake, it's a no brainer. If anybody wanted to put me in a compromising situation, they can. You don't even need necessarily to have the amount of tech that we've used to create the characters that I've played to do that anymore. But at a certain point, you would have. But it's like every, you know, but there are issues now about you know, owning your own digital identity, for instance. There's lots of questions about the future of digital resurrection. And someone, I was talking to the other day, someone at a con, about how would you feel about someone playing you in 30 years' time, you know, once you're gone. And I'm like, well, look, here's the deal. I've bought into this. If someone were to play me, rather like, you know, sampling music, as long as it was used in a creative way, and that, for instance, my heaps down the line, whether it's with the family or the estate or whatever it is, kind of, agree to it that it's a good idea, then so be it. I won't have any control over it. But it's a thought, you know, and because we look at Peter Cushing, we look at, you know, Harry Fisher, you know, all the actors who have been brought back using this technology. It's a very, very interesting time. Plus, also the other huge debate is, in a world where we are, rightly so, the acting profession is all, and the filmmaking profession, storytelling professions are all about equal representation. It's just like, and anybody being able to, or people being able to play what they, in terms of identity politics and so on and so forth. Here's a technology that allows you to be anything, and, you know, regardless of the color of your skin, the height you are, the sex you are, how you identify yourself. Here's a technology that does allow you to step into anyone's shoes or any creature's feet.
I'm amazed by your open-mindedness to what's such an existential threat to creativity. You know what I mean? Like, it's, you know, but that is a perspective that I had not thought of. It sort of unlocks the door for all people to, you know, please go ahead.
But also, but then the other side of that, you know, is an algorithm that can write a script for you. So that, you know, the formulaic perfect Hollywood script, you know, can be written like that by the tap of a button. Or if I imagine something conceptually, that it can pop up on a computer. If I want a chipmunk brushing its teeth, you know, then I can tap in that, the amount of imagery of chipmunks and toothbrushes, and it doesn't take much to put them together. Anyway, we digress.
Back to David, a bit bit more of an obtuse topic. How did you bring something? The serial killer is a very well-established villainous arc. How did you try to bring something new to that?
Because in a sense, again, he abjures responsibility for doing these things by saying, well, it's what people want. It's what people want to see. It's not, you know, I'm not doing this for my own good. I don't get any pleasure out of it myself. It's actually about demand, supply and demand. People want to see this. People want to see snuff movies. People want to see people, you know, injuring other people on screen as live entertainment. If that's what they want, I'm willing to provide it. It's in his head. He's putting it. He's bouncing it back. That's what I'm saying. He reflects.
Right.
The moral dimension he reflects back to the society that's out there and what it's willing to take, you know.
And then you and Idris have a pretty intense fight scene that I imagine is more his forte than yours. Talk to me about those days on set. I'm sorry, Andy, I didn't mean to offend you with that one. I honestly don't know how big he is, but he looks like he's got to be at least 6'2". I mean, that's a burly dude. What pops in your head when you think of those days on set?
Yeah, but I'm a 13th Dan Kung Fu expert. I'm not actually at all. I'm just, I don't even know if 13th
You could have
Dan.
Sold me on that one. It wouldn't surprise me.
No, Idris is a formidable opponent. And, you know, he is a genuinely skillful martial artist. And, you know, he's a kickboxer. So we had to find a fighting skill. I had a great, the stunt team were amazing. And, I loved working with them. I did quite a lot of training with them to find a way that would reflect David Robey's style of fighting, which is, again, it's not filled with any, it's just almost a kind of passionless sort of and minimal, you know, using the use of a knife. We used a blade which can be spun around and so on, but causing maximum damage with minimum effort and actually just avoiding, just more about avoiding techniques as opposed to, you know, trying to meet him full on, because that would never work. He's too strong. It is more like being a picador or matador in a bullfight, you know, standing back, dodging and then
to
just
use his own sort of speed and weight against them.
Correct.
All right, I got to move on to Star Wars now. You've been involved in two of my favorite Star Wars projects of all time. I'm somebody who, I didn't get to see the original ones until I was a bit too old, so I could see the sort of technological gap, And I was a kid when the prequels came out, which weren't necessarily kid friendly. So I didn't understand the Star Wars magic until I was a grown man. Rogue One came first. The Last Jedi came next, but Andor. Andy, let me tell you, and I think I speak for a lot of Star Wars fans out there, Kino Loy is one of the most, I think, revelatory creations in the history of the franchise. So honestly, thank you for that. I think he's sort of the perfect distillation of what makes this story so compelling. But with all that said, The Last Jedi and Andor are two of the more divisive Star Wars projects out there. What do you think explains that? I doubt it's because you're in them, but it just so happens that you are. So I'm curious your thoughts.
I mean, the thing is, I suppose it's what sort of Star Wars world you like. Do you buy it more into the grounded kind of Rogue One universe, which has a sort of, the logic is always completely believable because it feels more human and it's grounded in Earth. It's more earthbound in a sense. And the characters are, and they're all the nuance in the characters, the designs of all of the characters, and the sort of that it just feels like the kind of the gray, interesting kind of psychologically complex area of Star Wars storytelling. So people who like Rogue One and like Andor, seem to be at odds with the people who are more in love with the space opera, who love the fantasy elements, who want to transcend through this world. What's so brilliant about it is that they both work entirely and both are viable and real and touch people and move people in huge ways, but one is much, much more extreme and theatrical and of a sci-fi and fantasy feel, and the other is feels as real as anything. So but they can exist because it's a big galaxy, so yeah. they can both exist.
He, what I loved most about that show, and it speaks to the genius of the writing, is that the cut to blacks were largely like out of context moments. Kino Loy saying never more than 12 is one of the most sort of rallying cry moments that I could remember in Star Wars, but it's literally just a random sentence and a random fact stated between two characters. And that, to me, is so powerful. So I hope to see you pop up in season 2. I doubt you could speak on it, so I'm not even going to waste our time. trust me, I've been doing this a long time, as I'm sure you have. Let's move on to the Batman. Batman is my character. It's what got me into this world. I have loved him since I was a kid. What makes the film that you're in, the Batman, so great is that despite how many iterations there are, it did something new with that character. How are you hoping the sequel does the same to not only bring something new to the character, but to bring something new to its own series of films?
I mean, what we have is a very special ingredient here, which is Matt Reeves. He is a phenomenal storyteller, a brilliant filmmaker, a visionary film director, but also a great writer. And he again wanted to ground the Gotham, so it felt and it had its own internal kind of reality and internal logic. It feels very, very, very real. And what he wanted for Alfred and the relationship between Alfred and a younger Bruce was that sense of, well, he wanted him to feel like he could handle himself, that he was a soul, that and so with the backstory for Alfred, from my point of view, is that he was in the SAS. He was he's fought in campaigns. He's suffered injuries as a result. He's then worked with the MI5. He's then gone into top level security. He's worked maybe for like royal families or whatever, and then has ended up, being employed by Wayne Enterprises. So, and crucially, he was not there for Bruce at his moment of need and when his parents were assassinated. And he's unable to be, he should be able to be a father figure, but he is emotionally incapable of being a father figure. All he can do is to, again, sort of at a distance, and a painful distance, try and be the caretaker and the carer and someone who has that, the outward kind of like outwardly the sort of the parental role, but actually that can never fully be filled. And that is a very painful relationship. And so I think, you know, I don't know what's going to happen. I have no idea. Matt is, you know, dear friend of mine, and he's writing as we speak this next iteration. I just know whatever he does will have that emotional heft. I think that will continue. And at the same time, I don't know. I mean, I can't really guess what's going to happen, but I do know that I trust him with Alfred's life.
You know, and the Alfred casting, I find, is one of the more underrated dynamics of Batman, because he's not only a father figure, he's only the counterbalance Batman has in the entire world without him to keep him anchored to Earth. And then if you look in the long line of actors who played the role, you know, do you feel a sense of legacy pride in that? You've done multiple legacy defining roles, but does it feel special to be like, I'm one of the few who have played this character?
Yeah, and you do feel, I mean, you absolutely, you sort of feel a responsibility, but you also know that you are, in the same way that in these franchises, you become, and I've used the word before to explain it, and I think it's the right word, it's like you become the custodian of the role for a certain period of time, and you cherish it, and you love it, and you give everything to it, but it is much like doing a Shakespeare play. Or any play, you know, where you take the role of, say, Hamlet or whatever it is, Benedict or King Lear, and you totally immerse yourself in that world of the play, knowing that next year someone else is going to play King Lear and Hamlet and Benedict. You know, so whilst it's in your, you know, it's whilst you've got your hands on it, you do what you can to make it live and within the context of the world that we're in at this particular moment in time, and do your best with it. And then knowing that you will be passing the baton on. And there's something really enjoyable about that, because I love seeing, I mean, like, it's like the next Apes movie. I can't wait to see what goes on with the next Apes movie. You know, I'm excited to see that.
Now, while your character in Andor, his fate is up in the air, the character in The Batman is not. So I am going to press here a bit. I did see reports say that filming of the sequel is supposed to start in November. Can you speak to that at all?
I know that it's supposed to have a 2025 kind of delivery date. That's all I know. I would tell you, but that's all
Good
I know.
Good man. And then how about the Penguin show that just started to film this month? Any involvement in that at all?
No, and I know nothing about that either.
No, sir. Okay, well, I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about Lord of the Rings. What was that?
What's it called? Lord of the what?
It starred this little ugly bald fella that just wouldn't go away. Now listen, I don't know if I'm the first one to ask you about this, but a few weeks ago, reports came out that Warner and New Line are trying to make new films. You are one of the hearts of these stories. You are a defining character. How do you feel about this news?
Look, I mean, Peter Jackson, Fran Walsh, Philippa Boyens are sort of a second family that I have, you know, become part of and have gone on to make so many films with. And let me tell you, they are the best and most incredible people to work with. And I think that there are so many other potential Middle Earth projects which could come about. And if they're doing them, then I would, of course, you know, jump at the chance to have that relationship rekindled and work with them on it. Because, you know, after I finished doing Lord of the Rings, I was lucky enough to do an audiobook recording of The Hobbit. And then what followed on from that was an audiobook recording of The Lord of the Rings. And then after that, and I've just finished an audiobook recording of The Silmarillion. And so Middle Earth has never left me in a way. And I know for a fact that there are so many strands of those stories that can easily become their own journeys, you know. So yeah, I think it'll be incredible.
So as we close out here, I just want to ask some broad ones. Wit, because you've played truly some iconic characters, and I want your answers, not what the world might think about you. What performance do you hope, not think, hope stands the test of time of yours?
Look, it goes without saying that Gollum was a huge game changer character for me, because it opened up not only the world of Middle Earth all of that, but a whole new technology and a whole way of approaching creating characters. And so that was a big sliding doors moment of my life, where suddenly it threw into focus lots of different interests of mine, which I was a visual artist before I became an actor. And so it sort of, a lot of my friends on Lord of the Rings were also became visual effects artists and animators. And that whole world then became opened up to me. And I never expected that for a minute. And from that came, the experience of creating a company, the Imaginarium, and all sorts of things. So that role, apart from it being a very complex and demanding physically, vocally, and I think there's probably a good chance that I might well only be remembered for that role, because people, literally on a day to day basis ask me to do Gollum impressions or
voices.
Voices or, for their answer phones and so on. So I know that I'm pretty certain that that's going to be the one that I'll be remembered for. I can't believe what I'm talking about. But equally, I have a very, very, very strong feeling for the character of Caesar, because that playing a character kind of all the way through from birth through to death over the course of three movies, not only that, a chimpanzee who grows and changes physically, and as a recipient of an Alzheimer's drug, has an enhanced intelligence, and then becomes more human-like, and just the evolution of that character, and the sort of the joy and the exploration of that over three films, and then ending up where he does. It was, and working with the teams and fellow people.
And for me as a fan, those films were the ones where I was like, oh, mocap, whoa. You're like, I could see the furrow of your brow, man. That's just, yeah. Right. All right. And then real quick here, as I wrap up, final one. When I say the most memorable character performance you've ever performed, what pops in, most memorable character moment you've ever performed, what pops in your head?
I guess it would have to be the scene where Gollum and Smeagol talk to each other, because I'll never forget the moment at the Ziegfeld Theatre in New York in 2002, I think it was, of sitting there and watching Gollum, really, where he comes into his own in the Two Towers, and that scene particularly. The joyful moment of seeing an entire audience suddenly kind of just go like this, move forward and sit and kind of like, it was incredible. It really did make the hair stand up on the back of my neck, actually. Just because they couldn't quite understand what they were watching. And that was quite exciting.
Andy, I've got to wrap here. I've spoken to a lot of men and women in your line of work, but I was rarely as excited as I've been to speak to you today, because your work, just the sheer breadth of it, especially for a dude my age, I'm 30, I've grown up with you in everything I've ever loved, so thank you for that. This chat was a blast, and I also read online that you are a fan of the Gunners, so if so, you just got a few more months left. Hold on tight. Thank you, Andy. All right, thank you to Andy Serkis for joining me. That was one of my favorite interviews of my career so far. It's always good when I could talk to them for at least 15, 20 minutes, because then I could really get the hooks. Make sure to follow Brandon at @great_catsby and all the great work he's doing at Parrot Analytics. Make sure to follow me at Eric Italiano and the podcast at PostCredPod. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify if you haven't. Even though we slept through the show today, follow Cade at Cade _Onder and all the work he's doing at comicbook.com. And we will talk to you all next week for the finale, for the season 1 finale of The Last of Us and the latest episode of The Mandalorian. All right, y'all. Peace.